This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Closing ties to Colombian terrorist groups.
An agreement has been reached for a cleanup of a portion of the Portland Harbor. Snowpacks aren't looking all that good for Oregon's mountains. Mount Hood has managed to reach normal seasonal levels, but the same can't be said for the rest of the state. This will likely result in below normal summertime flows for the Columbia River Basin. The Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, posts rangeland maps for several basins in eastern, central, and southwestern Oregon. They range from parched to mediocre. Only the Willamette Basin seems normal. A 2008 analysis of snowpack in the Cascades from 1975 to 2007 by Mark Stollinger, research associate at the University of Washington's Department of Atmospheric Sciences, showed that in spite of rapid global warming, this period saw a 19% increase in snowpack. But NRCS hydrologist Julie Cobelli says the water year started off wet, but a dry spell in February and March has left many locations far behind schedule.
A piece of the Portland Harbor is finally going to see some cleaning up after 13 years of designation as a Superfund site. KBOO reporter Don Merrill talked to Travis Williams of Willamette Riverkeeper on the movement between it, the Portland, and the Environmental Protection Agency.
We're a nonprofit organization that works to protect and restore the Willamette River's water quality and habitat. And since the designation of the harbor as a Superfund site back in December of 2000, we've been involved in this project, and actually before that as well. And conceptually, it's kind of a very big project that ultimately runs from River Mile 11, which was the topic of that story today, almost to the confluence with the Columbia River, and it has a host of contaminated river sediments and riverside areas along that entire reach. So you're looking at about 9 miles of river there with varying levels of contamination. And so today's story was looking at one of the most highly contaminated sites within that larger Superfund site, and that's just on the east side of the Fremont Bridge there near what was known as the old Albina Shipyard.
Well, it looks like there is really no question as to who is going to be paying for this. I mean, the city bought the old Westinghouse plant that refurbished transformers, and a lot of the PCBs in the river came from that plant. And the city also owns the stormwater pipes that sort of sent the water and the pollutants into the harbor. So I'm just curious, what took so long to get to this point?
Well, the complexity of these situations are that this is one site within the entire Superfund site, and it represents the legal complexity of these Superfund cleanups when you have a whole host of what are known as potentially responsible parties. Those are entities that have some legal requirement to participate in the cleanup. So in this case, you had a small subset of those folks who are connected to this one site. And along with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, they basically came up with this settlement agreement. And this is where we have to give the EPA a lot of credit for continuing to keep this particular site at River Mile 11 kind of up as a topic of discussion with the City of Portland and CBS Corporation and Pacific Power to try to get these folks to invest in designing the cleanup. And keep in mind, this is a preliminary design for what will be formalized into a final design to actually get the cleanup going at this site. And the reason that matters is that once they finish the design of this cleanup, it'll hopefully coincide with kind of the final part of the process of moving forward with the cleanup of the entire Superfund site from River Mile 11 all the way down to River Mile 2.
Well,
approximately.
That's something I noticed about the story. River Mile 11 is the site that there was an agreement on for cleanup, but it sounds like that site is upstream of a lot of the other contamination. And so does each portion of the cleanup site that you were talking about have to be negotiated like River Marker 11 was?
Well, it's really going to depend on how there's a document at the very end of the Superfund process called the Record of Decision. And so EPA takes all the information they've gathered from a document called the Feasibility Study, and they design the draft cleanup plan. And once that is done and public comment is taken, then they formalize the Record of Decision. And then begins a process of the different potentially responsible parties of allocating the responsibility or figuring out who will take action at given sites. So in this case, it has a little bit of the flavor of moving ahead of the pack, if you will, because it's a site that's very well known and has very high concentrations of PCBs, and that's why I think these folks in the city and the EPA especially thought it was worthy of trying to, you know, advance the process a little bit ahead of the others.
That was Travis Williams of Willamette Riverkeeper talking with KBOO's Don Merrill about a pending cleanup of a portion of the Portland Harbor.
The giant sinkhole in Assumption Parish, Louisiana, continues its expansion, and estimates suggest it's grown to the size of a football field to as large as the Superdome since it was discovered last summer. More than 100 homes have been evacuated, and talks between area residents and Texas Brine, the company who's thought to be responsible for the damage, began last week. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with environmental activist and aviator Bonnie Shoemaker, who has flown over the affected area several times as part of the organization Wings of Care.
We've flown over the sinkhole in Bayou Corn 6 times now. The first time was August 13th of last year, and the most recent time was last Tuesday, April 2nd.
And can you share with our listeners what's happening there?
Well, let's see. First of all, what I can tell you as fact is that has tripled, maybe quadrupled, in apparent size, as you see it from the air. And there's quite a bit more oil now, as evidenced by the rainbow sheen on the surface. So that's consistent with the physics of what is explained to us has happened. With the collapsing cavern, all the gas and oil that exists anyway in the sediment beneath the ground gets squished together, if you will, pressured and pushed up. So that's what's appearing in the midst of the water, where we're getting gas and oil, not just in the sinkhole, but of course it's going through all the aquifers. This whole area is littered with oil wells, gas wells, and water wells. And when you get a density that high of holes, and then you have a collapse of the underlying structure, everything that's in each of those wells goes to the other wells. So now you've probably heard they're finding some of these explosive gases, methane, hydrogen sulfide, and others, underneath the houses in the community that are about a third of a mile away. And the oil, of course, we see on the surface. But this is you can't put this genie back in a bottle. It's not looking good.
How many homes are we talking about?
I believe it's over 100. I know that the number of families that are already talking about buyouts are up to about 90. And I think the number of families affected is over 120.
And from what I've read, it appears that commercial interests created these caverns?
Oh, yeah. A company named Texas Brine is responsible for operating this one that collapsed and several others in the area. And they're not mining oil or gas, as you might think. They're actually, I believe it's chlorine thereafter, which is a substance used for the plastics industry. Of course, these things are all related. And as I said, there are many, many oil wells, gas wells in the vicinity. But this particular mining of the salt dome for brine is used, I believe, in the plastics industry.
So who are some of the companies we're talking about in terms of who created this hazard for families to live around?
You can certainly say that Texas Brine will have to take legal responsibility for the collapse of this cavern because their drilling in this area created the weakness. But you could probably argue that there are so many wells in this general area, and these things are all connected, that it may have weakened the whole area. I'm not a geologist or geophysicist, and I'm not familiar with that part of this area. I'm sure the Texas Brine attorneys will be consulting with those and find out if there's a way for them to share the blame. But clearly the immediate blame for this cavern having collapsed would have been maybe a lack of prudence and testing beforehand. But to say more than that, I would speak beyond my expertise.
For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Vancouver police have completed their investigation of alleged sabotage at the United Grain Terminal at the Port of Vancouver. After a private investigation in late February, United Grain accused a member of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union of causing $300,000 worth of damage and locked all union workers out of the terminal. A prosecutor has been assigned to the case and will review the police investigation and decide whether to file charges. The longshoremen accused the company of punishing the entire unionized workforce for the actions of one employee who has already been fired. The standoff continues despite the lockout, with union picketers now accused of harassment. Last Friday, 10 picketers outside of the United Grain Terminal were videotaped blocking a car carrying 5 River Pilots through the picket line. One of the pilots, Captain Ann McIntyre, went on record accusing the picketers of threatening her family. Later, as the pilots maneuvered to ship into port, they were harassed again by picketers on boats with bullhorns. The pilots are neutral third parties to the dispute, but they must enter the port through picket and security lines and are thus targeted as scab labor.
Four Cornelius, Oregon police officers accused the city of outing them in their allegations of corruption in what they say was a violation of whistleblower statutes. The four officers have filed tort claims against the city claiming defamation. Cornelius City Attorney Chad Jacobs disputed the officers' charges. He said the city is confident that it was not involved in wrongdoing and acted appropriately. The officers' notice also alleged that the Cornelius police chief and his assistant contributed to a hostile and adversarial work environment. The officers claim the city made their claim public to their co-workers in the police department as punishment for making the corruption allegations against the city in the first place. In their notice to the city, the officers also requested to be placed on administrative leave during the city's investigation of the allegations. The city denied their request, saying some of the allegations had already been investigated and no criminal behavior had been uncovered to that point. This notice filing comes less than a week after the Cornelius Police Union dropped allegations of unfair labor practices against the city after the city acknowledged deficiencies in its bargaining practices with the police union. Those deficiencies were included in an intent to delay, obstruct, and interfere with the course of the bargaining. Attorney Daniel Denell, representing the Cornelius officers in the whistleblowing case, said that the city clearly violated the officers' whistleblowers' protection.
A circuit court judge yesterday handed down a restraining order against the Service Employees International Union Local 503, or SEIU, preventing a vote on whether or not to disincorporate the union as a nonprofit and reorganize it as an unincorporated association. Union officials, including Executive Director Heather Conroy and President Rob Sisk, claim that the change is necessary to exempt the union from certain nonprofit laws, such as the requirement that they have an annual meeting, a complicated and expensive undertaking for the 30,000-member union. The suit against SEIU was brought by former union president Joseph DeNicola, who last year won a different suit against SEIU when union officials refused to give him a list of all general counsel members. He also took issue with the way the board of directors proposed the reorganization to the general counsel, since by law all recommendations are supposed to come from the council and be implemented by the board. KABU spoke today with DeNicola's attorney Nathan Reitman, who said that both of DeNicola's successful cases against SEIU helped ensure that union members could communicate and make decisions among themselves. For example, now that the union has been forced to remain a nonprofit and thus comply with nonprofit law, it will have to hold those pesky annual meetings where members can meet one another as well as dispense membership lists on request. According to Reitman, this allows members to stay in the loop and not have all communication funneled through the union leadership. Dues-paying members of SEIU Local 503 thus retain some measure of control over the spending of union funds.
Attempts to block Washington state funding for the proposed I-5 bridge on the Columbia River was derailed today by state Democrats. Representative Ed Orcutt, an opponent of the proposed Columbia River crossing, has been pushing for reallocating transportation funds towards a new design. The Republican from Kalama says that the current proposal will do little to curb traffic congestion along the heavily traveled bridge. Orcutt introduced an amendment to the budget that would transfer $16 million toward a new design on the I-5 bridge. Last week, House members approved the state's $8.4 billion transportation budget without Orcutt's amendment. The House budget includes nearly $50 million towards the so-called preliminary design of the Columbia River crossing. Last week, Washington's Senate allocated approximately $81 million toward the project, Both versions of the budget face reconciliation before the governor can finalize the state's transportation budget for the year. In addition to the combined $900 million from Oregon and Washington, funding from the federal government and tolls are expected to contribute an additional $2 billion to fund construction for the Columbia River crossing.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud features members of the Q Center to discuss an upcoming event for the Oregon Queer Youth Summit on May 11th and how the community can get involved. Out Loud will also have guests from Youth Advisory Council and the Living Room, plus other local announcements. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock welcomes educators Hardari Davis and Dave Stovall in the first of a series of conversations about the current state of education in the U.S. Tomorrow's weather will be rain with a high temperature of 59 degrees.
It's 5:19, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
Morally wrong is how United Auto Worker President Bob King described last year's pay grab by one worker at Ford Motor Company. And this year, that worker has grabbed even more, hauling off a $21 million paycheck. Alan Mulally is the worker in question. Ford CEO, he has now pocketed more than $300 million in his 6 years as the carmaker's top employee. A period in which he forced fellow workers to swallow big losses in wages and health care benefits. The chief's gain and their loss means Mulally is rewarding himself with a salary that's about 360 times the wages of the typical Ford automaker. Meaning, Alan thinks he's worth 360 times more than the people who actually make the product. In addition to King, he should ask Peter Drucker about that. Well, he can't, for Drucker died in 2005, but Mulally could read up on what this solid thinker had to say about executive pay. Drucker was, and still is, a world-renowned management guru, author, level-headed social observer, teacher, and expert on the role of corporations in society. As a Bloomberg Businessweek writer noted in 2008, Drucker hated high CEO pay on every level, what it said about the individual as a leader, how it undermined the smooth functioning of the organization, and the way it tore at the fabric of society as a whole. The chief executive, Drucker pointed out, is just a hired hand who ought not to make more than 20 to 25 times the average pay that other workers get. As for prancing chieftains like Mulally, who profit personally by taking paychecks from fellow employees, Drucker was blunt. There's no excuse for it, no justification. This is morally and socially unforgivable. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a better place America could be if our leaders showed a little more Drucker and a whole lot less Mulally.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
On Wednesday, President Barack Obama will roll out a budget proposal called Chained Consumer Price Index, or Chained CPI, which will include cuts to social programs that could affect the most vulnerable, such as seniors who depend on Social Security to support their living expenses. On Wednesday, April 10th, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is mobilizing advocates across the nation in a congressional call-in to express their concern to congressional leaders. For more on this story, we turn to KBOO's Sequenia Wright, who spoke with Dan Adcock of Government Relations and Policy at Preserve Social Security and Medicare this afternoon.
What is chained CPI for those who are not familiar with the term and the wording behind it?
What it is it's an alternative way to measure general inflation that's been proposed as a new way to calculate cost of living adjustments, not just for Social Security beneficiaries, but also for veterans benefits, SSI, and also for federal and military retirement and would also affect some parts of the tax code. But in sum, what it would do is it would actually reduce all those cost of living adjustments that so many middle class Americans, especially the elderly and people with lower incomes, really depend on for their inflation protection. I mean, the problem we have today with the current CPI that's used, that it underestimates inflation for the elderly, because the elderly spend 20 to 40% of their income on health care, but health care is rising at a much faster pace than general inflation. So it seems counterintuitive why someone would suggest another type of consumer price index measure, the chain CPI, that would offer an even stingier and less accurate cost of living adjustment.
And why is Social Security part of this proposal?
Well, unfortunately, the president believes that in order to get the revenues that he would want from those in Congress he'll be negotiating a budget with, he feels that he needs to offer up cuts in programs like Social Security and Medicare. And of course, you know, I think, frankly, it also is because there's a lot of money in the Social Security program. You know, the bank robber Willie Hutton used to say, well, why do you rob banks? And he said, well, that's where the money is. Well, there's a lot of money in Social Security. There's $2.7 trillion. But this is money that Americans contributed to through their payroll taxes, and so these are benefits that they earned, and they don't contribute to the deficit, and that's why it should be totally off limits in any kind of deal to lower the deficit.
Is this a compromise because the Republican Party is pressuring the Democrats and President Obama to add it into this budget proposal?
Well, there are some in the Republican leadership who have said that the president is not serious about also offering up cuts to programs like Social Security and Medicare. And so the president believes he needs to do this in order to move the needle towards a what's called a grand bargain budget deal that would include revenues. But so far, the Speaker of the House and the minority leader in the Senate has rejected the proposal, and hasn't even hit the streets yet. It'll be released by the president tomorrow.
One other question I would have is, what is an alternative if Social Security should be taken off the table and should not even be part of the discussion? What would be a better alternative?
Our feeling is that, just to give you an example, at the end of last year and on New Year's Day this year, the Congress came to an agreement to avoid the fiscal cliff, at least temporarily. And in that deal, the typical person who would be affected by the partial rollback of the Bush tax cuts is somebody who earns about $500,000 a year. The loss of their income as a result of the rollback of the Bush tax cuts amounted to a 0.6% reduction in their income. Now, you compare that to somebody who would be affected by the chain CPI, and we're talking about somewhere between a 2% to a 3% reduction in their income. And we're talking about people whose average benefit is $1,200 a month, and about 40% of the bottom bracket of income depends on Social Security for nearly 90% of their benefits. So the middle class and working class, especially in terms of stagnant the wages, have already really given up so much. And our feeling is that any budget agreement should make up for something like the chain CPI with additional revenues to ensure that people who have done very well in this economy pay their fair share.
On April 10th, there's going to be a seniors mobilized to do a call-in day to congressional leaders. Do you want to speak a little bit on that to our audience?
Yes. The National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, which has about 2 million members and supporters, we're mobilizing our membership, and we're inviting the entire American public to participate in a congressional call-in day to oppose the chain CPI, which would lower their Social Security COLAs, by calling 800-998-0180. That number again is 800-998-0180. And anyone calling that number will be connected to the Capitol Hill switchboard, and they can be connected directly to their representative and their two U.S. senators.
Okay, and I have been speaking with Dan Aycock, the Director of Government Relations and Policy at the National Committee of Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Thank you so much, Dan, for giving us a little bit more insight on this budget proposal and what folks can do to get involved.
Not a problem.
I'm Sequoia Wright with KBOO Evening News.
Chiquita Banana filed a reverse Freedom of Information lawsuit last week against the National Security Archive. The company is working for security purposes to block the release of documents related to illegal payments it made to Colombian terrorist groups. In 2011, the National Security Archive published documents from Chiquita's own personal files called the Chiquita Papers. Chiquita claims the archive published the Chiquita Papers to foster biased mischaracterizations of the company in a media campaign. For more on the story, KBOO's Sean Stewart spoke with Michael Evans, director of the National Security Archive's Columbia Project.
Could you tell us who you are and the organization that you are affiliated with?
Yes. Well, my name's Michael Evans. I'm director of the Columbia Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. The National Security Archive is an independent, non-governmental research organization. We are dedicated to government transparency and the use of the Freedom of Information Act to research the activities of the U.S. government, mainly with respect to national security policy and foreign policy. So the Chiquita part of it is part of a bigger project that I have, investigating the sources of violence in Colombia using the Freedom of Information Act, essentially, you know, probing the U.S. government for information about the violence in Colombia. And the way I see this, you know, what I'm calling the Chiquita Papers, I think they're really the most important collection of records anywhere on corporate links to terrorist groups. You know, remember, these are Chiquita's own records. Just unusual to get corporate records from a Freedom of Information Act request. However, they turned over these records to the SEC for 6 years, from 1998 to 2004, at which point they basically became government records. They were part of a government investigation. So at that point, they become subject to the Freedom of Information Act. And remember, Chiquita's already admitted to funding these groups. They pled guilty in 2007 to funding the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, what they call the paramilitaries. They did this for 3 years, even after it was designated a foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. Before that, they made similar payments to the guerrilla opponents of the AUC, another illegal armed group that's been engaged in, you know, open warfare with the Colombian government for nearly 50 years. And what Chiquita has done here is really, for the National Security Archive, unprecedented. In nearly 30 years of Freedom of Information Act and Freedom of Information Act-related litigation, the archive has never once before faced what we're calling here a reverse Freedom of Information Act request. And it's appropriate because it's essentially, you know, a FOIA in reverse. With this action, Chiquita seeks to shield from public view evidence of its ties to paramilitary and guerrilla groups in Colombia. And we know this. I mean, we know that that's the information that they want to hide here. We know it because that's what the investigation was about. We know what the outcome of the investigation was. We know that they pled guilty to those same acts in 2007. All we're asking now is for the National Security Archive, members of the public, to be able to judge for themselves whether Chiquita's explanation for this behavior stands up to scrutiny. And we think in the initial publication we did in 2011, there's indications and evidence to believe otherwise.
What can you tell us about the lawsuit that was filed against the National Security Archive last week?
Right. Well, the Chiquita Brands International has filed a lawsuit in order to stop the release of records to the National Security Archive, my organization, about its record of paramilitary payments, that is, the terrorist payments in Colombia. They pled guilty in 2007 as a result of a Department of Justice investigation to making those payments, and during the course of that investigation, information about a number of other sort of illegal armed groups in Colombia that the company had been paying off over about a decade. So this is their attempt to block the SEC from releasing additional information, a potentially much more complete file on the terrorist payments than we've seen before. They are using what's called a reverse Freedom of Information Act request. It's not actually a Freedom of Information Act provision, but that's essentially what it amounts to. They're trying to force the court, federal court, to stop the Securities and Exchange Commission from releasing these important records.
That was Michael Evans, director of the National Security Archives Columbia Project, speaking with KABU's Sean Stewart about Chiquita's attempt to block the release of documents detailing the company's deals with Colombia's terrorist groups.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, April 9, 2013. Palestinian woman injured by Israeli settler and troops uproot trees in southern West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian young woman was injured on Tuesday midday when an Israeli settler ran her over with his car near the village of Beit Umar in southern West Bank. Local sources said that Ala Al-Alami, 22, was on her way home in Beit Umar village when the settler ran her over and fled the scene. Palestinian ambulance was called in by one of the villagers and took Al-Alami to a hospital in the nearby city of Hebron. Also near Hebron City today, Israeli army bulldozers uprooted 350 trees owned by local farmers from the village of Al-Dhahriya. Villagers told local news that the soldiers uprooted 200 almond trees and 100 olive trees. Troops also sprayed a chemical poison on the land where they uprooted the trees, local farmers reported. In the Gaza Strip, the Israeli army has decided